Audi.
Welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Life's not always been full of laughs for comedian Phil Nichol. For a start, he was born in Britain's number two crap town, not even number one. Moved to Canada, then was banned by his born-again Christian parents from wearing jeans until 17, and once had a terrifying encounter with wild dogs while searching for a Nazi-themed socialist folk music bar in a dark field outside Bangkok. And don't even ask about Troughman. I will let him tell you all about that himself. Please welcome the wonderful Phil Nichol.
Calmer in person than I imagined you
be,
because I've seen your stage shows and you're off your rocker.
It's as much of a character as Stuart Lee says he's a character, which it is. If you know Stuart, it's not as far a cast of a character, but he's actually really gentle and quite, he obviously is a bit sarcastic, but he's not as full on, but neither could he be.
Tell me, what is your stage persona?
I've got two different settings. One is for club comedy, the Comedy Store, the glee clubs, the stand comedy clubs. It's full on, frenetic, loudmouth, a bit sweary, do anything for a laugh, like to climb into the audience, play the guitar. For the tour that I'm doing and for my sort of Edinburgh Festival style show, which are longer form shows, it still is frenetic and crazy, but it's less sweary, more thoughtful, and a bit more philosophical.
You're on a large tour at the moment. Tell me where you're going.
The tour has started already, and it's taken me all over Britain. I've got 35 dates at the present, and it's taking me to Canterbury, Aberdeen, and then to Brighton, I think, and everything in between is probably the best way to describe it.
Which is your favourite place? When you mentioned Brighton, my heart lit up, because I'm a Brightonian currently in exile in London, and I love going back to Brighton. But where's your best audience, do you think, across the UK?
Brighton is certainly up there. I'm a left-leaning person, but I'm not a soft left-leaning person.
So you're quite a hard left-leaning.
I'm quite contentious in a lot of ways. I don't go with everything, but Brighton certainly is one of the more open-minded groups. But I do like playing this in Newcastle, and the Aberdeen Comedy Festival, which I've done before, should be electric, because it's the second year of it, and it was really successful last year. And Aberdonians are crazy.
Is that
people.
What they're called? Aberdonians?
Aberdeen.
Are you making that up?
Aberdonians.
Aberdonians?
Are you from Aberdeen?
Well, you're Scottish, aren't you?
I am.
You sound like you're Canadian because you were brought up in Canada. Tell me about the, what's the history?
I was born in a place called Cumbernauld, which is really sort of nasty. I don't know, say if you're from Cumbernauld, I love you, but I was born in Cumbernauld.
But you're all a bunch of nasty bastards.
There's a book called Crap Towns that comes out every year. It lists the crap towns, and Cumbernauld's always number two. Never wins. But Cumbernauld...
Can't even win that, can
No, Cumbernauld is not a place to travel to. It's the end of the line of a very short line from Glasgow. The council of Cumbernauld actually wrote to Channel 4. Channel 4 were doing a TV show where they tear down a landmark in your city, like a garish landmark. And the city council of Cumbernauld asked them to tear down Cumbernauld and rebuild it. I mean, that's not a joke. That actually happened. They wrote into the whole people, everyone voted and went, can we just tear it down and start again?
Why? Is it like 1960s? Is it all a 1960s sort of mess?
It's a new town. It was designed by an Italian designer. I can't, his name slipped my mind right now, but at the time they were designing these new towns, there's lots of cul-de-sacs and lots of little twisty, turny roads. Just trying to turn it into a country feel. I mean, I went back on my 50th birthday, and it was fantastic fun to go. I mean, I'm sure there are lovely bits of it, but even people in Cumbernauld make fun of Cumbernauld.
So it hasn't been gentrified in any way?
Can't imagine it being gentrified in any way. Although they do have a lovely little theatre there. And the house that my father actually built the house that I moved into. He was trying to have it done by the time I was born, but I was 6 weeks old when I moved into the house my father built. And my father is a cabinet maker and a builder and a working class man by trade from Clydebank. And he saved up all his money and built this house, and he couldn't afford to put the roof on it.
Which is not good with a six-week-old baby, by the way.
Not at all.
No roof.
And his mother, he went to his mother to ask her for the money. She wouldn't give it to him. So he had to work even harder to get the money to put the roof on.
Would she have had the money?
Maybe.
Why did she not give it to him?
I don't know. I think she just wanted him to work harder.
I tell you what, not having a roof is a good incentive to work harder.
It sure is. So my father was a builder, a cabinet maker by trade, and he built this beautiful wall inside that's hard wood that he was gifted from one of the men at the church that he used to go to. So it's a bungalow. The entire wall is this hardwood paneled wall with a door that you can't quite see. Like, it's got one of those doors that opens that you got a little key, like a little lock
in it.
Yeah, a little secret door. And it separated the bedrooms from the house to the common room of the house.
Wow.
And I went back. When I went back, I was taking a photo of it. And there was a guy washing his car out front. He went, "Hey, what are you up to?" And I was like, "My dad built this house." He went, "What?" And I said, "My dad built this house." He went, "Are you serious?" I was like, "Yeah, it was 1965, just before I was born." And he went, "Oh, come on inside for a cup of tea." And he took me inside and he said, "Oh, we've redone the whole thing. It's all got all new, you know, kitchen and all the bedrooms are all been redone, but this wall," and he had the wall there.
Wow.
And the wall that my father had built from hand, beautiful dark wood, paneled, like hard wood, like, and it was gorgeous. And he said, "Oh, this will never go. This is the reason we bought the house." Actually, my father bought the house and he sold it to me. And so I got a picture of taken in front of the wall,
the big Nicol family wall. But that sounds like something out of a James Bond film almost, in Cumbernauld in the 1960s,
yeah.
You know, to have this amazing wooden wall with a secret.
The way I told my father about it, it must have been a lot to him. He built the wall, I think, before he probably built the roof.
Can afford the wall, we can't afford the roof. So how did the family get from, apart from fly, I'm assuming, or
yes,
maybe they went on the boat from Scotland to Canada? What took you there and how was it?
Well, actually, my father told me the story because my mum's going to be 90 next year. My dad is 87, still going, and all their faculty's there. My dad was telling me the first time he went to Canada, he had to take a boat, you know, and he was in the lower classes, like third class, and it took him months to get there, and he worked as a cabinet maker on the government buildings, is because they were trying to get young Scottish guys. So he went with his brother and a friend, I think, and they worked on these government buildings, and then he came back and met my mum, and then we flew out. By the time the 60s, I flew there. It was 1970 by the time we got there, so we all...
So you were 10 years old.
I was four and a half years old. I was there for a whole year of kindergarten.
Remember any moving?
I remember little bits about it. I remember being in Canada and it being very strange because we were Scottish and we were working class. I was given my brother's sort of a hand-me-down school outfit and I was really small for my age, so it was baggy. It hung off me and I had sandals on and a little tie and a blazer. I went to school my first day. In Canada, kids don't wear that stuff. They wear jeans and t-shirts, so I got picked on.
Oh, can imagine.
And I skipped a grade because I went to kindergarten in Canada. We moved back to Scotland because my parents didn't really enjoy living. My mum didn't enjoy living in Canada for the first year. She missed her friends, missed her mum, missed all that stuff. So we moved back to Scotland and I went to school for 2 years in Scotland. But because I'd already been in kindergarten, I skipped a grade and I was born in May. So I was already a year young for the people my age. So I was in this class, I was almost 2 years younger than everyone, up to everyone's elbow with the Scottish accent. I had a stutter and a lisp. I had my Scottish school uniform on and my parents were devout born again Christians. So it's fair to say I got picked on all the time.
Oh no, bless. See, that's heartbreaking. Well, I was going to say, as many comedians do, is there a dark past?
Well,
this is your dark past, what keeps you going, the impetus to comedy?
Yeah, this is, well, it's actually the basis of the show that I'm doing on tour, which is called You're Wrong, spelt Y-O-U-R, just to irritate the grammar Nazis. Talk about my life growing up and how it formed my sense of humour, because I'm quite aggressive and abrasive on stage, but actually I'm not. Off stage, I like Thai green curry and I cook at home and I'm a big softie, really.
I'm quite intrigued about your parents sort of hopping around. They went back to Canada after a while. They were like, okay, we realised that we made a mistake coming home, we're going back.
Yeah, what happened was in the late 60s, 70s, the Canadian government were trying to get immigration happening and they wanted people from Europe, and there was a lot of Portuguese and Greek and Italian builders going out to build houses, and they needed Brits, they needed Irishmen and Scotsmen and some Englishmen, but mainly Scotsmen and Irishmen to go out because they could be supervisors. So they gave them supervisor positions because they needed people that could speak English fluently enough to talk to the housing people.
Why not the English? Can we not speak English fluently enough?
I don't know if the English were actually builders like that, but that, as far as I could see, it was mainly Scots and Irish. Yeah,
I touched on this recently with Kirsty Walk. We've had a lot of Scottish people on. We've had Kirsty Walk, George Galloway, Edith Bowman, but Kirsty Walk was talking. She's written a novel which is inspired by people, two novels actually, heading to Canada and heading to America from Scotland, inspired by the Andy Goldsworthy sculptures, I think they are. We were talking about this. It's like what it must have been like, particularly like when your dad went on a boat, to be leaving behind your friends and family, going out into the unknown, taking a boat for months and not knowing what you were going to encounter.
And not knowing if you're ever going to come back. I think a lot of people left in those days to not come back. Didn't really say why he came back, but I know he was very close with his mother. His father passed when he was a teenager, so he went straight into a job as an apprentice joiner. and then went out there to try and find, create a new life for himself. But I think maybe his mother needed him to come home. But at the time, I think he told me, I don't know if this is true or in his imagination, but he said it was £4 to the dollar, Canadian dollar at the time. So when he came home, the job that he had in Canada as a 20-year-old, when he came home, he had four times as much money as his mates who'd been working the whole time as joiners and cabinet makers in Scotland. And he said he had a scooter and all sorts of stuff that you wouldn't have had as a young man. So he's a bit of a show off, my dad.
It's great when that happens, though, isn't it? It doesn't really happen to us anymore. But I remember going to Australia when we had $3 to the pound, and the States when we've got $2 to the pound. And now I don't even want to look at what it is.
I went out to New Zealand the first time, and it was $5 to the pound. I remember being in South Africa. I travelled to South Africa to the Cape Town Comedy Festival, and it was 16 rand to the pound. It's now about 3 or 4.
So you've ended up here, and you're doing really well here. Does it feel nice to be embraced by the British audience?
Very much so. Very much so. I mean, I've been here 22 years, and I use the UK as a base for all my travel. And one of my reasons for coming here was the comedy scene is so vital, fertile. I wouldn't say vital, but it is vital, but it's fertile. And when I came 22 years ago, it was really at a peak, and it was really, the live comedy was the thing to do. Obviously, television comedy's taken over, and they've marketed and put it on. So you do have a kind of a glut of comedy on television, but there's still so much great live comedy place to place to place. So even if you're traveling within this country. But what's happened across Europe and now Eastern Europe and all through Southeast Asia is comedy clubs are springing up everywhere. And because people are speaking English more fluently all over the world. So I've been to Oslo, to Stockholm. This tour is taking me internationally to Estonia, to Latvia, Lithuania, Helsinki, Amsterdam, to Paris, to Berlin, hopefully Barcelona. These are regular comedy shows that happen all year round.
No, I didn't know that. I obviously knew about the great stalwarts, Amsterdam, Paris, Berlin, but I never knew that Eastern Europe and was such a good place for comedy.
Absolutely. I did a show in Bulgaria in Sofia, which was a fun. I did three shows there in the National Theatre of Bulgaria, which is exactly what you think. It's sort of Soviet-era looking theatre. And we got on stage, and it was like a really tinny mic with a white mic cord cable. It was really weird. But the people that came were over the moon. And the people that came were Bulgarians who were learning English, who were kind of advanced in English. And they're really desperate to have any kind of Western culture. But then outside, it was very, very, I don't want to say grim, because that doesn't sum it up right. There's a feeling of energy in the place. But it's very, very grey.
There's a lot of concrete, isn't there?
There's a lot of concrete.
Yeah, there are some beautiful buildings, but there is still a lot of concrete and grey. Imagine people say that about the UK, don't they? People that aren't used to our grey skies.
Well, it depends where you go. I mean, you know, London's one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Every time I come back, if we walk across Hungerford Bridge either side, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. I mean, Waterloo Sunset. Every time I hear the song, you can't. If you've been to London, it's hard to, I think, unless you're from Paris or Berlin. If you're from a city like Toronto, where I'm from, London is a beautiful city, absolutely stunning.
Describe to me your best experience when you've been doing these European circuits. Yeah,
the European circuits.
Yeah, let's go with those.
Well, let's go European circuit. Okay. Do you mean the best show I've had or the best?
Just the best experience. Actually, I'm looking for stories.
You're looking for stories.
Yeah. Tell me a story.
Well, I've got lots of stories. I love Amsterdam. Been going to the comedy clubs there. There was one called the Comedy Cafe in the Maxhuplein, which was one of the first comedy clubs there. They used to eat monkey nuts and crack them open while the show was on. And I don't know if you know much about the Dutch, but they've got a great sense of humor, but very quiet about expressing it. If you weren't doing very well, you just hear people cracking monkey nuts, and the floor would be covered in them. So you could hear people getting up to go to the toilet, you know. And it was just, they had actually had a phone. I'm not making this up. They had a phone on the wall in the original comedy cafe. There was a balcony, and there was a phone on the wall, and a phone on the wall of the stage. So they could ring you and tell you to get off.
Seriously, yes, did you get the call?
I never got the call. I actually used to ring up to them and go, how's it all going?
They could phone you to get off.
Well, I'm not sure that's what it was there for. I think it was there to make drinks orders, but like old fashioned. But it was an old fashioned phone with a ringer with the dial on it.
Did I hear about you having a wild time at Pride in Amsterdam?
I did. Do you want me to tell you these stories though?
Yeah, I mean,
this is very polite. So I was playing the Tumler, which is my favorite place to play in. Toomler is run by a comedy collective, the Underground, Comedy Underground. So it's all run by comedians. It's really egalitarian, and the staff are gorgeous. So it was Gay Pride, and they decided to take us out. I was with a comedian called Adam Bloom, who decided to stay at the club. We'd been out the night before, and he was a bit worse for wear. So I went down with a friend of mine, a guy that I'd met, Pierre, and we went to this club called The Eagle, which was right beside a club called The Cock Ring. And The Cock Ring's gone now, but it used to be, you know, it was a big dance club, and it had a huge metal cock ring, was the symbol outside, right? Am I allowed to talk?
Yeah, you're allowed to say cock ring. I lived in Amsterdam for a while, but I never saw the cock ring.
The cock ring. I can't remember the name of the strat that it's on, but it's right off the red light district, and I can't never remember the. It's a little long, narrow road that runs up to Dam Square. Beside the cock ring, my friend Pierre is one of the gayest men that I know. He's like, he's going for Gay Man of the Year every year. He said, look, let's go to the Eagle. Next door, the Eagle's got this little red door, and it's got an eagle on it. If I remember correctly, you had to sort of bend down to get in, because, you know, Dutch people are really tall, but for some reason, a really door, and you go in, and then you know the buildings in Amsterdam are long and narrow, and there's like six floors of them with big, little, tiny, thin steps.
Really steep steps.
So I'm standing at the bar having a drink and, you know, chatting away to someone, and my friend Pierre comes out and goes, whatever you do, Phil, don't go to the toilet. And I'm like, what? He goes, whatever you do, don't go to the toilet. And to me, that's like saying, Phil, go to the toilet, right? So I run up the stairs and I go into the toilet, and there is a guy sitting in the trough. He's naked, except for a scuba mask and a snorkel, right? Trough's about four men long. It's like one of those lovely old ceramics. It's an old building. And he's right in the middle of it. And I was like, and there's people weeing, and he's sort of bending over and putting himself in the way in the streams of their wee. And all I could think was, when in Rome. So, and I need to go to the loo. So I started going to the toilet, and he leaned over, and so I just thought, well, may as well. He's obviously there for a reason. So I weed on the mask, and then I try to get some in the snorkel and push him down like a cigarette. And he was really happy. He was smiling the whole time. He loved it. And I went back to my friend Pierre. I went, that was amazing. Amazing. And when we left, I called some friends of mine in Toronto. I lived with a gay couple in Toronto, James and Jordan, when I left acting school. And I called James. He's one of my, James Watson, if you're listening, James, hi. He's one of my best friends in the world. And I said, look, I've just weed on this guy. He went, oh, that's Trough Man. He's famous. He's famous. He became famous at the Rubber Balls, and he travels around the world going to different gay prides, and he pops up places, and that's him.
I should get him on the podcast.
Yeah,
you should. As long as
we
have a wash first.
Unfortunately, he's passed away.
Oh, no. Seriously?
And people always go, and I jokingly go, he's hit by a car. No, that sounds horrible.
Did he drown in a big vat of urine?
That sounds horrible. But, you know, he passed away, sadly, and there is now someone doing a tribute called Son of Trough Man. It's not his actual son, but someone going to the Rubber Balls and doing that. He's American. He was American. So that was my claim to fame for Gay Pride.
I'm speechless. I was laughing at him. Now he's dead.
I'm not really sure if that's the best story for traveling.
Well, no, it is.
Hey, guys, if you want to go traveling, go to Amsterdam. Go to the Eagle.
I've taken my mum to the red light district in Amsterdam, but actually I had a very similar experience, which I feel, whether I should say it or not, I don't know, but I'm going to say it.
Yeah, you can always edit it
Berlin,
out.
In Berlin, did you ever go to the Kit Kat Club?
Not been to the Kit Kat Club. I've heard about the Kit Kat
Club. The Kit Kat Club, we were out partying in Berlin with a big group of
not
people.
With your mum.
Not with my mum, not this time. And it got to about 6 a.m. when you think, where should we go now? You know, when you think, that's a bad move, but where should we go now? So we stopped and asked someone. They said, you want to go to the Kit Kat Club? We're like, great. Jumped in a taxi, Kit Kat Club, please. It was going like out of town. We're like, oh my God, what are we going to be mugged here? You know, what's going on? And it pulled up in this warehouse, and there was a big velvet curtain, and we were actually in black tie. We'd been to this posh event. So we were in all these suits and frocks and everything. And we went behind the curtain, and they said, oh, you can put your clothes over there. And we just thought it was a language thing. You can put your coat in. So we took our coats off, you know, put them in the cloakroom. And then we went in, and it's this big S&M club when everyone's half dressed and in leather, and there was a man on the podium doing something to himself that I won't even talk about. There was another man standing over the mezzanine level over the bar where you're ordering drinks, and he's doing something to himself. You're like, I don't know if I even want to drink. But my then boyfriend, now my husband, needed to go to the loo, and he's like, oh my God, I need to go to the loo. It's like, what? You know, we stuck it out for two drinks. We're not gonna wimp away from this stuff. We all started to get a bit competitive. My friend who was New York, she was like, yeah, we see this sort of stuff in New York all the time. And I'm like, yeah, we see this stuff in London all the time. It's like, we've never seen anything like this.
Oh, right.
So David went to the loo, but with trepidation. And he said when he was in there, he met a man in a gimp outfit. And the man in the gimp outfit said to him, there's this boy out there, I really like him, I don't know what to do, you know. And he sort of confided in David, and David said to him, grabbed his rubber hand and said, follow your heart. And he had, they had a little cuddle, and the man in the GIMP outfit presumably went off to follow his heart.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful.
I know, it's a
I went to Torture Garden a number of times in Mass in Brixton. I mean, it's a fantastic night. I'm not a fetishist. A friend of mine was performing the first time I went. They have a cabaret room. And they were doing a crazy magic act. So, and I've got some, you know, it's mad stories. But there's a certain amount of respect that goes along with those places. So it is a bit like that. It is a bit like I'm just looking for someone to tie me up.
It's, you know, like, to me, it was a little bit sad, if I could say that. It felt like there were maybe, excuse the pun, but tortured souls there.
Well, maybe. Because I thought that as well. And I don't know if it's a projection. I don't know how wonderfully happy they are in their everyday lives. And I don't know what the S&M's, what purpose it serves. It's not something that I have pursued or that, but I mean, I'm quite square when it comes to that stuff. I mean, for me, that trough man moment was like a life-changing moment, I thought. And you know, really great over dinner conversation.
Love the way this conversation has taken a turn. We've gone from travel and comedy to S&M and weeing on people.
I know, but it's my life hasn't always been like that. I also like roller coasters but I was thinking of crazy places. When you're going out of town, you're wondering where it's going. I was in Bangkok at a night by myself. The other comedian that was with me was a diver, so he'd gone off to do dive. And I had a night by myself at this beautiful 5-star hotel, and I was like, well, I'm not going to sit around a hotel, and I'm in Bangkok. And this is before I was a really, you know, I've traveled the world a lot now. At the time, I didn't really know. Someone said, go to the Koh San Road. I was like, oh, I'm a little bit nervous about that. I said, I want to go and see some music. So I've looked through the music. I went to end up in this heavy metal bar that had like a mouth. The front of the club was a mouth, and the door was one of the teeth that opened up, right? And I went in, and it was no one in it. And it was like all, this is before the movies came out, but it was all sort of the Hobbit, sort of Lord of the Rings, dripping walls. But then this tile, black and white tile floor. It was crazy. This throbbing Thai thrash band singing Crazy Train by Ozzy Osbourne with long, long hair down to their knees, each one of them just like thrashing around. And I'm like, there's three of us in this big place, and I'm just going, this is hilariously weird. And then the guy stops, and I can't do the Thai language, but they stop, like, Latin on a crazy train, and he starts introducing the next song, and I just thought, oh no, no one's going to believe me when I tell them this. It was just like, these guys don't speak any English at all, but they know every single word to every single Aussie song. Oh, it was great. But I left there. I saw in their version of Time Out that there was a folk club that did Thai folk music that was written for the unions, Thai workers' unions, so like a socialist Thai folk club. And it was on this address, and one of the features of the place is it had Nazi insignia and these Nazi banners,
nice.
Like full-on Nazi banners. But the club had been taken over by this group of hippies, by these socialists who sing Thai folk music, right? And I know, so I'm like, that to me, that's like, Phil, you gotta see this. So I got in a taxi in Bangkok and said, here's the address. I'm sure the guy the address, and we start driving. And I'm thinking, and this is before Satnav, before I had my phone. So we're driving out of town. I'm thinking, oh, this is the, like, Bangkok's now behind us. I'm like, excuse me, I'm going to this address. He goes, yeah, just a bit further. And he keeps driving. I'm thinking, no. And I'm like, excuse me, can you? And I'm now in the middle of nowhere. Then I see a row of shops. Now, literally in the countryside, there's a row of shops with a restaurant with a couple of tables outside. And I was like, hey, pull over here. You're taking me out of the way. So I got out. And I said, where is this club? Tell me where it is. And he pointed down a road. So I was like, oh, I really think I'm getting ripped off here. So I gave him the money. I got out and I walked up to this, there's a young couple sitting. Like, the guy looked like kind of what you'd see in a Thai movie, like a Thai gangster looking guy. Great big muscular guy with the chains on and stuff with his girlfriend in the middle of nowhere. And I said, I'm looking for this address. He went, yeah, it's just down there. So I started walking down really far away, like half a mile. You could see a little flashing sign of a club. And I got about halfway down and I thought, what am I doing? What am I doing? I'm surrounded by wild dogs. I'm walking towards a pool hall. When I get close enough, see, it's just a pool hall. And I'm thinking, this is not where this place is. And I don't know why. I think the dog scared me. The whole thing, I suddenly went, all the hair on my back went up. And I just thought, this is how people disappear, Phil. This is what you're doing, exactly the thing. You're not supposed to, you're by yourself. No one knows where you are. You haven't told anyone where you're going. And you'll lose everything. So I turned around. The dog started chasing me. I ran back. Dogs were barking at my heels. And I went back to the guy. And he was, fortunately for me, he spoke a bit of English. And he was like, oh, mate. No, he goes, I thought you said pool hall. And I was like, no, it's a Nazi club, right? And I'm trying to describe it to him. And he's looking at me like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Like, he's looking at me like, what are you talking about? And I'm going, yeah, it sounds really crazy, right? And he went, yeah, it sounds ridiculous. He went, I said, what can you do? He said, well, you've already come so far out of Bangkok that the taxis won't take you all the way into town. It's not worth their while. So you have to take a taxi to this garage where it's a turnaround station where other taxis come and loop out. I was that far away. This taxi driver took me so far down, I nearly lost my life. It was like a dusk till dawn type situation.
But you never found the Nazi never hippie found it. Folk music.
And I've looked it up. Joint. I've looked it up again, and no one ever believes that it's there. And no one ever believes me. I do. There's a place in Manila called the Hobbit House, which. I'm the kind of person, I said, there's a place, because I love traveling, and I look, and when I was a teenager, there was an article in the paper about a place called the Hobbit House in Manila, where all the staff in the restaurant are dwarves, and I just thought, and I just thought, well, that looks like amazing fun. I was reading the Lord of the Rings at the time, this is before the movies, and so we got to Manila, and I said to the guys, the comedians, look, let's go to the Hobbit House. And they all laughed and went, there's no such thing as a Hobbit House. I was like, no, they're all dwarves. And they're like, Phil, shut up. You're winding us up. So I turned to the driver, the young driver, and said, do you know a place called the Hobbit House? And he went, no, there's nothing called the Hobbit House. I was like, come on. We didn't have smartphones way now. We just had the old Nokias. So I keep asking everyone. The Hobbit House. No, it's 11 million people in Manila. It's got to be a place called the Hobbit House. 3 days go by. The comedians make fun of me. Hey, why don't we go to the Hobbit House? Why don't we go to the Hobbit House? And on the way back after the last gig to the hotel, I said we'll go for a pizza. And the comedians go, well, why don't we go see if they serve pizza at the Hobbit House? A different driver, he turns and goes, you want to go to the Hobbit House? I'm going, there's a place called the Hobbit House? He goes, yeah, of course, it's famous in Manila. I'm like, you go to the Hobbit House? Yeah! And we drove to the Hobbit House and we got there and they were just closing. And the bouncer, who's about maybe 3'11", like big but small. We went, sorry, mate, you can't come in. And we were like, no, you gotta let me in because it's these guys didn't believe me. And I explained to him, and he went, well, okay, you can just have a look. We'll come in. The bar's closed. So we went in. They got us a drink, a short, a little joke. It's true though. They got us a little drink. There's a place called the Hobbit House, owned by a famous Portuguese singer who had a number one hit in Brazil in the 80s. He had a couple of friends in the sex industry who were dwarves. The sex industry in the Philippines is if you're, I think if you're a dwarf, it's probably maybe it's changed now, but I think it'd probably be an obvious place for you to go. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just think unfortunately you fall into it. This guy said, look, I'm going to open a club. My band will play. He's got a hit song. He plays there with his band every Thursday, and the place fills in. People come from all over the world to the Hobbit House, and he's saved all these people who are dwarves, or little people, I should say. And I don't even know if dwarves are correct anymore. And he's put them to work. So as we left, this is true, as we left, I, being a little cheeky and being comedian, I said to the bouncer, I said, thanks for that. I got a T-shirt and everything. Do you know, is there anywhere else where we can go? Is there anywhere else where there's dwarves working in the city? And he looked around like he was, and he went, I leaned in, he went, well, I'm not supposed to tell you this, because there's two guys that worked in the kitchen got caught for smoking dope last year. They've opened their own bar down on the beach called Little Guys, and it's open till 4. So we're driving across Manila in this van going, let's go to Little Guys. And we got to Little Guys on the beach. So if you go to Manila, there's along the waterfront, it's not actually a beach, it's the bay. There's all these little bars, and there's a bar, I don't know if it's still there, it's called Little Guys.
You're actually getting in a taxi like, where can we go where we can see more dwarves? I mean,
it's because they didn't believe me. That sounds going to make me sound horrible. I can only apologize to my friends who are little people. It wasn't the excitement of seeing little people. It was the excitement of knowing there was a place that I wasn't crazy.
It sounds like a brilliant place.
Well, I've been to Australia. I've been to Australia. One of the most beautiful places I've ever been in Australia. It's in the Wamboin National Park. I love New Zealand, but I was married in Australia. Uh-huh. I married a woman when I was young in Australia. But New Zealand.
Oh, you married a woman? I didn't think you were in that.
No, I don't know. Are you allowed to marry in Australia now? Yes, you are.
Yes, you're allowed to marry in Australia. I
worry because Australian politics are so messed up right now that they're really fighting. They're fighting a similar battle as they are here and in America, where there's a lot of right-wing thinking is taking foreground in politics. But anyway, travel-wise, my ex-wife, Kate, hello, Kate, we're still friends. We'll be friendly again. Her father had this little house in a place called Womboyne, which is in the middle of a national park. He passed away when he was in his 90s, and she was an only child, and he had her when quite late in his 50s. So we were quite young when he was quite old. When he was young, before World War I, he was that old that we had tried to join the army, and they wouldn't let him because he had flat feet and asthma. So he stowed away with a dog. He had a dog. He stowed away with the dog to New Zealand. Couldn't. They turned around. He sent him back. So he went for a walk on walkabout, what they call walkabout, and up in this place called Womboyne. So this is before the government really. This is when Australia was quite new. It's not that old a country. He landed on this beach. It's like an estuary in the middle of Womboyne National Park. It's got like a 7-mile-long beach facing Danger Bay, which is a shark-infested water, and then this freshwater estuary. Set up camp and built a little hut. And then he got a couple of his friends, so there were 6 houses there. When the state government showed up and said, oh, we're taking this land for the state government, he said, well, we were here first. And they took them to, he'd sort of become a self-made man. He had enough money to take the government to court, and they won the right to keep their 6 houses. The national government then wanted to turn it into a national park. He did the same thing. By that point, he was one of the richest men in Australia in the 1960s with a company called Steelcraft, who made prams. Because after the war, he was in Australia thinking, when the guys come back, there's going to be lots of babies born. So I'll make all this money. And he fought the national government and got to keep his place in Womboyne on this freshwater estuary, which I was lucky enough to visit. And it's one of the most beautiful places. You can now drive all the way in. They've now put roads into it.
But you were lucky enough to check up and marry with daughter of one of the richest men in Australia. That's very good.
Yeah, well, I didn't know that. I didn't know that at the time. I honestly didn't know that at the time. I think that maybe that's one of the reasons he liked me. We're no longer together. Anyway, so... But the Womboyne is still there. Womboyne is still there, and you should go and visit it. Although she probably told me not to say that because they like to keep it quiet.
I'd love to go. I've been to Australia several times, but I've only been around the outside edges. And I've got a big trip planned in about a year's time where I want to go to the interiors. I want to go to those quiet little places. I've done all the Sydneys and the Brisbanes and the Melbournes and all that. I want to go see Uluru. I want to just travel.
Have you been to Darwin?
No, I haven't been to
Darwin. So you go to Darwin and you can go into the Northern Territories. You can go into the Kakadu National Rainforest. And you get a guide, Aboriginal guide takes you in because it's on near the Arnhem Land, which you can't go into. You have to get a permit. Even as Australian national, if you're not Aboriginal, you can't go into the Arnhem Lands. I have only seen it in film because Kate's father was able to buy himself a permit. I'm assuming he donated a lot of money to the conservation of the Arnhem Lands. And he showed what you can see. The red sand at the top part of Australia looking up towards Papua New Guinea is absolutely stunning. Closest you can get is Kakadu National Rainforest. And you sleep in the swag, you sleep outside. They tell you, I'm sure they're scaring you, but maybe not. They talk about how the alligators, the crocodiles can come. They come like deep inland away with their hungry. They come all the way up into the mountains. So you can be swimming in a freshwater pond in the Kakadu National Rainforest and there still might be alligators.
There's so many things in Australia that can kill you. Have you read Bill Bryson's book on Australia? I think it's called Down Under.
Down Under, yeah.
I think it's the opening chapter, but it's got like a chapter on what can kill you in Australia. Mm. And the list is about 200 long, you know, crocodiles, funnel web spiders, box jellyfish. I think that gives the Australians, though, that sort of gung-ho sort of attitude that I love. Yeah.
Well, maybe that is, yeah. Maybe knowing you can die at any point. I mean, I've been chased by large spiders, which funny as a Canadian, because we've got like the Mississauga rattler is the only thing that can kill you in Canada other than...
What can kill you in Canada?
It's called the Mississauga rattler. It's a snake.
Oh, yes, a snake. You've been chased by large spiders.
I mean, you could be killed by a moose, but you'd have to be an idiot.
You could be killed by a chihuahua.
Or a bear. True. Yeah, what that chihuahua that nibbled on its master's neck. She passed out and...
Oh, no. Anyway. Yeah, these things happen, yeah.
Anyway.
So
New Zealand.
New Zealand, yeah.
So, I mean, I'm really lucky. I've been to every continent but Antarctica. I mean, was lucky to go to Brazil with what I do, Rio de Janeiro. I got to interview Bebel Gilberto, who's the son, granddaughter of João Gilberto, who wrote Girl
and
from Ipanema.
And very well known in her own right.
Oh, she is. Oh, yeah, there she is, royalty. Mm. Super famous there. And really, really lovely. She's an absolute sweetheart. Beautiful woman as well. I went to Jamaica. I ran the reggae marathon in Jamaica, which is on in every December if you want to go and run a marathon.
Why is it a reggae? What makes it a reggae marathon?
Well, they call it a reggae marathon. You start in there's, if you've been to Negril, there's one long strip where all the bars between the road and the water, there's all the bars, and they're open all day, all night. I think they try and empty them out around 6 in the morning. Unfortunately, or fortunately, the reggae marathon starts at 5 in the morning because it gets so hot. By 9, you've got to be off, you've got to be finished. Every half a mile, every mile or so, there's a sound system. There's a car with big speaker on top of it, or they have steel bands, people cheering you on, and it's just a reggae theme. And when you cross through the finish line, you get a coconut with a straw in it, fresh coconut with a straw, and then you can run across the finish line, down the beach, and then straight into the ocean and lie in the ocean.
And that sounds like the sort of marathon, the only sort of marathon that has ever sounded appealing to me, the reggae marathon in Jamaica.
Absolutely.
Well, actually, we're running out of time.
Durban. Yeah. stayed in the Zimbali Lodge. We did the Durban Comedy Festival. They put us in the Zimbali Lodge. It was a 6-star, it's a honeymooner's lodge in the middle of the Zimbali National Park. So really quiet. And it was like 10 comedians. We were really interlopers. We were the interlopers because there's also nothing to do. So we were smoking cigars and playing cards until all hours. And then the honeymooners would be getting up. But we had our own little cottages and we had a personal butler, which I couldn't use because I thought, I can't use a butler. But then the guy next to me, the comedian next to me, he came over and went, my butler is complaining. I go, what about you? Because, well, you're not using your butler, and he's getting in trouble because he's never been called down. I went, what are you talking about? Well, there's a button you're supposed to press if you need something. He goes, you haven't used it yet. I was like, well, I don't want to because I'm feeling a little uncomfortable. I'm happy. I don't need clean towels and sheets every day. So he was like, yeah, but he's getting in trouble. So I said, oh, no, I didn't realize. So I pressed the button. He came down. I'm like, yeah, he was really excited. Oh, yeah. And I said, look, I don't want to get you in trouble. So here's what we're going to do. Just come down at 2 o'clock every day and buy a cup of tea. So you come down, have a cup of tea, and sit on. We had this beautiful balcony that looked over like wild monkeys and springbok. It was amazing, absolutely amazing. Highly recommend the Zimbali Lodge. If you're a honeymooner, 100%. No, don't go during the comedy festival because there'll be comedians there. Any other time, it's the most beautiful honeymoon place. And you have your own little cottage and it's got doors that open onto a balcony looking into absolute paradise.
Do you feel lucky that you've been able to do all this travel through your work?
I really do. I really do. It's one of the best things I've been able to do with comedy. And I still have so much to look forward to because, as I've said before, I'm taking my show You're Wrong on tour, which is taking me to all these amazing places. Luckily, I'm able to stay usually for a day or two. And I'm doing a month in New Zealand at the Auckland New Zealand Comedy Festival. Ideally, I haven't heard from Australia yet, but I'm hoping to hear from Australia all through Southeast Asia. So I'm going to Singapore and Kuala Lumpur. And last year I did shows with my partner, who's also a comedian, and we did shows in Tokyo, Osaka, and Fukuoka. And we were able to go to Nara and go to the big temples and stuff. If you're in Japan, go to Nara. There's two huge temples with the biggest, I think it's the second biggest Buddha in the world. And right beside that is a Shinto temple, one of the oldest Shinto temples in Japan. It's a must see if you're in Japan.
I haven't been to Japan. I think you've traveled more than I have, actually. Well, I thought I was doing quite well.
Well, maybe lucky.
I'm in the wrong business, yeah. The travel business. I should have gone into comedy.
Yeah, you could do. Yeah, yeah.
I don't think I've got the skills.
You do. You've got the skills. Go on. It doesn't matter. After a couple of years, everyone can do it.
Oh, yeah, maybe. It's true. Need a lot of confidence, don't you? Or at least pretend confidence to get out there and risk the fact that you might not make anyone laugh.
We'll go full circle to the beginning of the conversation. I think I had to build confidence because I had such a bad, not bad, it wasn't a bad start. I mean, I'm my family are gorgeous, but growing up with a stutter and a lisp and being raised in a born-again Christian family, I wasn't allowed to wear denim until I was 17. I was a nerd and went to a foreign country. I was an immigrant to Canada, even though I was, English-speaking immigrant. I was still an immigrant and treated as such and got picked on and bullied and moved around a lot. So it's turned me into the person I am today, which is now I've loved traveling and I love meeting other people. And I think it's, if anything was going to heal the ills of the earth, and I'm not just saying it because it's your podcast, but travel broadens the mind and you start to realize that people are the same wherever you go.
Absolutely, which seems like a beautiful place to end it. I do have one question to ask you. However, just before I do that, what is unchristian about denim?
Well, I was raised in this the Brethren Assembly, who at one point in their development thought that buttons were evil. So they thought they, because buttons were the new clasp and they come undone too easy.
Oh, I see.
Buttons are so, you know.
Oh, so those sort of jeans that just fall off you.
Yeah, that leads to sex standing up. whereas I think they prefer the old, you know how hard it is to get a woman's bra off? That used to be on everything.
Have they not tried wearing skinny jeans and trying to get them off in a hurry?
Well, that's maybe why they moved to Canada, because you've got to wear 9 layers. See, you just know. If you're a Canadian, I always say this one thing that I love Canadians, but Canadian women in the winter dress practically. They wear big hats and big, I mean, and it's, I find it kind of really sexy and gorgeous, to be perfectly honest. But when you go home with a Canadian woman, it's like pass the parcel.
I'm not good with cold. I have no practical clothing. I really don't. Anyway, let me ask you my last question. My last question is always about music, because to me, and many people agree with me, music and travel go hand in hand, because it helps you evoke beautiful memories, solidifies a memory in many people's minds about travel. So if you had to choose one song, it doesn't have to be your favourite band or artist. It'd have to be one song that reminds you of a special or otherwise a travel memory, a time of place of travel. What would that song be?
A time and place of travel memory.
It's hard, isn't it?
You know, there's so many, because I travel with music. I love music. I play music. I've written music, and I have very eclectic tastes. So I'm not, you know, it's not going to be a Beatles song or a thing. And are you going to play the track?
I can't afford to, but I'd
okay.
Like to.
Well, you can put the track on. It's a bittersweet memory. I'd broken up with someone, and I was traveling back from Thailand. I'd been there for 8 weeks to sort myself out. I decided to take myself off the grid, and I went to Koh Tao, and I went diving, and I've got all my diving certificates. I'm a rescue diver. How about that? And I got really lean. I took boxing classes. So diving one day, box the next day, eating really healthy, riding a scooter around, and decided to stay there. I enjoyed it so much in Koh Tao. I stayed for another 5 weeks and became quite friendly with the locals. A friend of mine introduced me while I was there to a band called My Morning Jacket, who write these beautiful ambient sort of rock songs. And the guy sounds a little like Neil Young. And there's a song at the very end of the album Circadal, which is from 2011. There's a song called Moving Away. And as I was flying out, as the plane was taking off to go home, and I was going home to going back to being alone, the song Moving Away. And the song Moving Away is about actually moving away from the person that you are with. And I felt that 8-week-long trip had helped me move away. And I just remember being in floods of joyous tears. Here's my stutter going, my joyous tears as I left Bangkok to fly back to London, my home.
Thank you so much, Phil. You're adorable, despite the trough man tales. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week for more Big Travel Podcast.